This evening, what I had in mind to do was to give a talk that perhaps is kind of like a review talk. I wanted to give a basic, perhaps unblemished, unelaborated presentation of the mindfulness practice that is the core of what our sitting group is about and the practice that we do. The practice of sati, which is translated into English as mindfulness. And the core discourse of the Buddha that presents the teachings of mindfulness is called the Discourse on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And in there, the Buddha says that the practice of mindfulness, is the preeminent way of becoming free of all forms of grief, lamentation, despair, sadness, and suffering. And so the practice of mindfulness is a practice which leads not only to the freedom from all forms of suffering that we live under, but it also is the access, the entryway in Buddhism to the Dharma. And the Dharma is the fundamental aspect of our experience, fundamental aspect of truth. And the entryway to, it's interesting that the description of the Dharma given by the Buddha says that the Dharma is always in the present. It's always here and now. And in being always here and now, it's timeless. It has no beginning and no end. It doesn't belong to the world of time. Time belongs to the world of comparative thinking. Comparative thinking is an activity of mind which is involves a doing. And the timeless quality of the present doesn't involve any doing on our part. The Dharma is a very interesting expression, which means something like, come and see. Some people translate it as inviting inspection. That the Dharma, or reality, in its fundamental quality, is inviting us, come and take a look deeply into what our experience actually is. And it's something that, and the Buddha continued by saying, the Dharma is something that we can experience in ourselves. It's not something that to be experienced or learned from others. It's not something to be learned from books. It's not something to be figured out through our logic and reasoning. But it's something that we can discover in ourselves through our own ability to see very deeply into the very nature of our experience. Now, so the Buddhist tradition then puts a tremendous emphasis on mindfulness and being aware. And awareness is something that all of us have. And there's many qualities that come together with awareness for many of us, many factors of mind that are tied together with how we pay attention to what goes on. The quality of awareness that the Buddha was emphasizing in the practice of sati, of mindfulness, could be called bare attention. Where it's kind of naked awareness. We see things unclothed by the concepts and ideas we might have about what those things are. Bare attention. The cultivation of bare attention is the fundamental thing that mindfulness practitioners are trying to learn. Most of the ways in which we pay attention, even if we're able to stay in the present moment, many of us, even in the present moment, will paint or cover our experience with concepts, with ideas, with judgments, elaborations. And the practice of mindfulness is trying to step back below the level of concepts. And can we experience things without our interpretations? A very small example of this, early times in my life where I started to get a sense of how this might work was when I was a new student at Tassajara. And there was... Tassajara has this wonderful hot bath. And it's a place where people go and soak and get warm. And these wonderful hot plunges at Tassajara were also used to incubate yogurt. And the kitchen would have these very large frames, about 5 foot long, about a foot wide or something, and they put all these big, you know, gallon mayonnaise jars or something, glass jars, and filled with milk and culture, and they would stick it in the hot lowered into the hot tub, and they come back, I don't forget, 6 hours later or a day later or something, and lo and behold, there'd be yogurt. And I remember standing and looking at the hot bath when it was an incubator, and wondering about, what is this a hot bath or is it an incubator? And is there something in the fundamental nature of this thing that I was seeing in front of me, that is it fundamentally an incubator or is it fundamentally a bath? I don't think, in its fundamental nature, it's neither. It's we, in our use of it, make it into something. In a certain kind of use, we make it into a hot tub, hot baths. So another kind of use, we make it into incubator. We could put a sign on it saying, no more bathing, and then it only is an incubator. Or we can stop, maybe they stop nowadays.
Peter? I haven't seen them do it anymore.
So they don't do it anymore. So now it's no longer an incubator. So, in another kind of very mundane example, if you have a small table, short, slow table, you can use it as a table, or it might work just as well as a stool. You can sit down on it. Or it might work just as well as a stepping stool to step up and get something on a high shelf. It's quite adjustable what the actual object is. There's nothing inherent in the wood being put together that makes it a table. What makes it a table is our use of it. So I don't know if this is very convincing examples for you, but as human beings, we assign concepts and ideas and meaning to objects of the world that are not inherent in the object itself, but rather have to do with the ways in which we project onto that object. Now, this is quite innocent, I think, in terms of hot tubs and incubators and tables. But we do that also with ourselves and with our friends and with our activities and with our jobs and with almost everything we touch. Human beings will paint their reality with interpretations and concepts and ideas and judgments. So what we're trying to cultivate in the practice of mindfulness is the practice of bare attention, where we slowly begin finding out how to be present for ourselves and present for our experience of life in its bare essentials, as it actually is, before the interpretations were laid on. The interpretations can be very rudimentary, and they can be quite elaborate. There's this wonderful expression in Pali, in Buddhism, called papancha. Papancha is usually translated into English as elaborations or fabrications, proliferations of thought, proliferated thinking. It's one thing to hear a sound of a bell, and then you think, you hear, that's the sound of a bell. You'll hear it for what it is. But very quickly, some of you might form opinions and ideas about what you just heard. Oh, that was not a very nice sound. Or that was a very nice sound. And I wonder if I could hit it better than Gil hit it. Or, you know, I wish that, you know, that doesn't seem quite a fit into what was going on today. It's supposed to be all words right now. And so now I feel suddenly this jarring thing is happening. What's supposed to be happening, Gil's supposed to be talking. And now he hit a bell. And so the elaborations and the associated thinking can build and build and build until sometimes we're primarily living in our concepts and constructions and elaborations rather than in what's actually going on. So the practice of mindfulness is to begin coming back to the raw, basic aspect of what's actually happening and just noting it, seeing it for what it is, a sound of a bell. If there is interpretations and judgments and elaborations, then the practice is simply to be aware, oh, there's a judgment. And as we do this, the practice becomes kind of like a practice of surfing. I think it's a very nice analogy for mindfulness. It's kind of like surfing on the bare essential of what's actually happening moment to moment in our direct experience. You hear a sound of a voice, just a sound of a voice. You hear someone next to you rustling, you hear the rustling. You have an itch, you feel just the itch. You feel an ache, you feel an ache. As opposed to hearing someone speak and then going off, and maybe 5 minutes later you come back and you realize you're listening. You were listening, but something in what was said triggered a whole bunch of associations and elaborations, and before you know it, you're designing your own Dharma talk, saying how you could do a much better job. I used to do this when I was a new Zen student. I used to kind of sit there listening and say, you know, just wait until I become the abbot. I can give a much better talk. And in the meantime, I wasn't listening anymore. I didn't know what was going on. So just to stay very simple, to stay simple. The way to keep it simple is almost by using a statement for everything you're aware of. You just say, this is what's happening now. 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 And if, as long as you keep doing it that way, steadily, happening now, then you're much closer to mindfulness than you are if you are noticing what's happening now, and then you get carried away by a big wave of judgments, of interpretations, of associated thinkings, of all kinds of other things that might happen. And then maybe 5 minutes later, you remember, oh, what's happening right now? As human beings are kind of like meaning machines. We just love to find meaning in things. And so we start elaborating what the meaning of something is. So we sit here in meditation, and perhaps you're not very concentrated. Maybe the mind is wandering. What's happening right now? Oh, what's happening right now is the mind is wandering. What's happening right now? As opposed to, boy, I'm not very concentrated. I'm really a lousy meditator. But this is hopeless. It was the wrong day to come and sit. How could they have chosen Monday nights? You know, Tuesday nights would have been much better for a meditation group. You know, you're kind of more rested after the beginning of the week or whatever. Friday night would be the best. No more thoughts about work, you know. And then it takes you 5 minutes before you come back and say, oh, what's happening? Oh, just a human being here is thinking. So if you can just preface everything you say with mindfulness, everything you notice with mindfulness by the statement, what's happening now is this. What's happening now is this. Then the tendency to elaborate and make meaning and judgment is interrupted. And that's what we're trying to do in mindfulness, is to interrupt the constant assigning of meaning and judgments and interpretations on top of our direct experience. And some of you will find this a great relief, because it's really exhausting to go around with all the interpretations and ideas and meanings that we assign to our experience. Most of them which aren't particularly relevant or true. Someone famous said something like, I've had many troubles in my life, most of which never happened. Mark Twain said that? Thank you. So then in the cultivation of mindfulness, the Buddha emphasized beginning with paying attention to the breath, mindfulness of the breathing. And mindfulness of breathing, sometimes people will have this idea that it's kind of like a beginner's practice. Mindfulness of breathing is a phenomenally powerful and advanced practice in its own right. And it's said in the tradition that it was with the mindfulness of breathing that the Buddha attained his enlightenment. It's also said in the discourses, after the Buddha was enlightened, he would periodically go and retreat himself for 2 or 3 months at a time. And he would tell his students, if anybody asks what I'm doing on retreat, tell them the practice I'm doing is mindfulness of breathing. It was that important that the Buddha really stressed it as his own practice. Mindfulness of breathing is very simple, because simply paying attention to our breathing, the sensations of respiration, expansion and contraction of the torso, of the body, going through the nostrils, just whatever happens in our body, whatever way our body experiences our breathing, we bring our attention there. And part of the virtue of this is that our breathing is almost always happening. And so we always have something concrete and practical in the present moment to bring our attention to and be aware of. As we do something as simple as the breathing, it counters all the tendencies we have to be involved in interpretations and judgments and assigning of meaning to our experience. We begin slowly to simplify that part of our mind. And it can be a real challenge. our thoughts and our cognitive activities can be so powerful that it actually can be very hard to stay with the breathing. But to bring some strength, some dedication to stay with the breathing begins to overcome the power of our cognition, the power of being involved in these associated thinking and elaborations. And we begin simplifying our mind. We begin softening the hold of our interpretations have on our experience. Because our interpretations are all a doing. Our judgments are a doing. Our associated thinkings are all a doing. And in a sense, the practice of mindfulness is a kind of undoing. It's learning not to do so much. Learning not to do all this judgment. And for many of you, it's a huge relief to do this, because so much of the ways in which we feel anxiety, so much of the ways in which we feel stress in our life, has to do with a doing of our own mind. So rather than understanding all the complexities of what our mind does all the time, there's tremendous power and freedom and wisdom in starting to learn how to undo all the doing. And when we start undoing all the doing and have an experience of simplicity, just being with ourselves in a very direct, simple way, without judgments, without assigning a meaning on ourselves, then it's such a relief. We have access to tremendous feelings of peace, of silence, of ease, of well-being. So the breath is a very powerful way to begin undoing all the doings that we do. It's very, very simple. The doing of paying attention to the breath is such a simple doing and so practical and straightforward. It begins to help us let go of, to soften, to clarify all the ways in which we elaborate. As we can stay more carefully and more steadily on the breathing, simpler and simpler, and more luminous, more and more transparent and clear and in the present moment. But the Buddha did not leave us only with mindfulness of breathing. In the discourse on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, he also stressed the importance of paying attention to our embodied experience, what's happening to us physically, both in the physicality of the sensations, to live in our body, to feel our body, because that not only is that a present moment experience, unencumbered, but the body experience is a source of tremendous understanding about life and our experience of life. And if we get access to our embodied experience, it's like a shortcut through all the ways in which we're trying to figure things out through our thoughts and our ideas. You don't have to, you'll be told a lot of the truths of life if you listen to your body. But if you listen to your thoughts, you spend an endless amount of time having to try to figure it out. It's a lot harder. Some of the deepest truths you can experience in your spiritual life are most easily accessed through being embodied, through feeling your body. And part of the reason for this is that the separation of our mind and our body is another form of doing, which many people in our culture have gotten to be very good at. There's a tremendous lessons that our culture teaches us growing up about the keeping distance from our body, or emphasizing giving priority and value to our ability to think and figure things out with our mind. And as we internalize the interpretations of giving value to thoughts and ideas and interpretations, we internalize a kind of wall or kind of separation, or kind of pushing away, or kind of a closing down of our embodied experience. And it's a kind of doing. It's a kind of activity of the mind to do that. And as the mind becomes simpler, and as it does less and less, the separation, this arbitrary separation between the mind and the body begins to dissolve. And the natural balance between the mind and the body becomes much more part of our lived experience. In teaching mindfulness of the body, the Buddha also stressed the importance to the activities of the body. Not just simply paying attention to our body as we're sitting here, but as we're walking. Know that we're walking. As we're chopping vegetables, know we're chopping vegetables. As we're driving, know we're driving. Know the activity the body is doing. Know the posture in which the body is in. To know what's happening in the present moment. To always come back to that. To always come back. What's happening right now? To keep it so simple, the practice, that you're simply stating to yourselves, very quietly, this kind of silent mind, this is what's happening now. This is what's happening now. This is what's happening now. Very continuously, letting the mind, letting the heart become quieter and simpler as you do that. The Buddha then stressed the value of paying attention to our feelings. And when the Buddha talked about feelings, he did not mean, in this case, our emotions. But what he meant was the feeling tone of our experience. The feeling tone of our experience, every experience we have, whether it's touch or smell or taste, or whether it's mental activity, has a tone or feeling tone to it that is one of three tones. It's either pleasant or neutral. And if we can learn to see very directly in the simplicity of the direct experience whether something is pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, then it's possible to see the various ways in which we begin elaborating and interpreting and reacting to our raw experience based on whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. We are tremendous, we're kind of like amoebas. You know, the kind of amoeba-like response to pleasure and pain. We pull away from uncomfortable situations and we will grab on pleasant ones. And not just simply that, but the movement towards and away from pleasant and unpleasant is one of the primary sources for how the mind begins to spin out into all its elaborations. And if we can train ourselves through mindfulness to simply see experience in its simplicity of its pleasant and unpleasant quality, we'll find a tremendous power of staying in the present and staying free in the present moment. You see, a tremendous power to bring mindfulness in between the actual experience we're having and all the elaborations and reactions and habits of the ways that we respond based on whether things are pleasant and unpleasant. So the Buddha stressed the importance of very simply, is this thing you're noticing in the present moment, this is what's happening now, this is what's happening now, is that pleasant or is it unpleasant or is it neutral? And if you can see that, can you notice, is there a response within you based on that pleasantness and unpleasantness? Then the Buddha said it was very valuable to notice the mental state that you're in. Every moment of life, there is a mental state. And that mental state is colored, shaped by all the different impulses and reactions that the mind can have. And so to notice in the simplicity of the states, just this, right now, I'm happy. Right now, I'm sad. This is what's happening now. Right now, there's a concentrated mind. Right now, there's a distracted mind. Right now, there's a depressed mind. Right now, there's an aversive mind. Right now, there is a delighted mind. What is the mind state that you're in each moment? And the practice is to state it very simply. This is what's happening now. This is what's happening now. This is the mind state I'm in. This is the mood I'm in right now. This is very different, I think, than the way most people experience them. Mostly, we experience a mental state in the mood and we'll assign a judgment, an interpretation, a meaning to that state. I'm feeling lousy, that means I'm a lousy person. I'm feeling depressed, that means I'll be depressed forever. This means I won't be able to cope. This means this, this means that. This means this about me. I'm having this mood, I better not let other people see that I'm having it. I'm having this mood, I better go make sure everybody knows I have this now. We do all this stuff to it. There's all this doing. And partly because our moods and mental states, we're very quick to identify with it, identify it as having some relationship to who our self-image is. And our self-image is a huge preoccupation for many of us. It's one of the huge doings which exhausts the mind. And in the practice of bare attention, the Buddha was saying, when you're feeling happy, just know you're feeling happy and leave it at that. When you're feeling depressed, just know you're feeling depressed and leave it at that. Can you get to the bare simplicity of the actual experience you're having? You might protest and say, that's not going to help me solve it. That's not going to give me any understanding of it. That's not going to make it go away. You'll be surprised if you actually cultivate the ability to stay. This is what's happening now. This is what's happening now. This is what's happening now. You'll be amazed at how quickly things begin to unravel for you. You'll be amazed how quickly your preoccupations and fears, your anxieties will begin to fall away. I remember reading some years ago a study by a psychological journal, of a psychologist who was working with someone who was, I forget what the mental state was, but some very, very severe psychological disorder. And the person had, the psychologist didn't want to teach Buddhist mindfulness. So taught the person, said, okay, when you go home, I want you to bake bread. And while you're baking bread, I want you to name each thing you're doing while you're doing it. Now I'm kneading the bread, now I'm sticking it in the oven, now I'm looking at the clock, now I'm setting the alarm, now I'm doing this. Just name everything you're doing while you're baking the bread. The person came back the next week and reported how well they started to feel. And it became a key for that person to learn how to function much more successfully in life by learning how to stay in the present moment with what's actually happening, as opposed to getting carried away in our fantasies and our ideas of what's happening. So can you be aware of your mood, your mental states, the state of your emotions, in the raw simplicity of it? Maybe you don't want to do it in your normal life because you have all kinds of reasons why it's not a good idea to do that. But can you do that in your meditation? When you sit in meditation, can you stay with the raw simplicity? Oh, this is the mental state. This is the mental state. This is the mental state I'm having right now. The same thing with our thoughts. Our thoughts, for some people, are even more closely associated with ourselves than our emotions. Can you see a thought in the simplicity of just a thought? Oh, there was a thought. Now, it's very difficult to do that because most of us will automatically believe our thoughts. That was a good thought, or it must be true. If I say I'm lousy, it must be true. But the practice of bare attention is to see, oh, that was just a thought. Now, one of the things you might be noticing as you're doing this is that you're bringing to bear on your experience an aspect of awareness, an ability to notice what's happening, which is independent of the judgments, elaborations, and ideas about what's happening. If you can simply say, oh, that's an idea, that's an interpretation, that ability to say that and see that as an interpretation, that is free of the interpretive process. So slowly we're beginning to strengthen that ability of mind, that ability of cognition, of seeing, which can see things without tying it to anything else, without tying it to our judgments, interpretations, and assigning a meaning. And in particular, not tying it to an idea that this is me doing it. If you stay in the world of bare attention, just noticing this is what's happening now, this is what's happening, this is happening now, and then you have the idea, oh, I'm the one who's doing the practice. You know what that is? That's a thought. That's an elaboration. So you can just note, oh, there's a thought. And poof. That part of us that notices that we're thinking, this is me, is not me. Isn't that great? Because you have to have a thought, you have to have a doing to create the idea or the sense, this is me doing it. So you step outside of that if you're really diligent and careful, just noticing, oh, this is what's happening now, this is what's happening now, this is what's happening now. Practicing in Burma, my teacher Upandita was very careful in training us and teaching us to experience just to our meditative life, to use the mindfulness to see things in the simplicity of actually what's happening, as opposed to interpretations. And one of the forms this took was, if I showed up for an interview and said, "Oh my God, you know, it was really hard today. You know, I was sitting there and I could hardly stand it and felt so overwhelming. And I don't know if I can do this practice. And, you know, can you help me?" Out the door I went. You know, he wasn't going to talk to me. No way. Because I was coming and describing my experience through a huge filter of interpretations and ideas and self-identifications and elaborations. Me, it's all having to do with me, having to do with me. The raw simplicity of the experience, which is such a relief to really settle down into, is, oh, there's a knee that's hurting, there's pain. The pain. I'm feeling discouraged, as discouragement. I can be aware of the discouragement as a kind of a drop in energy, kind of a depressed quality in the mind. And if I really stayed there and felt that energy and the depressed quality in my mind, it began to lift a little bit. And as it lifted a little bit, I became more aware of the physical pain in the knee. And then I brought my attention to the physical pain and it began to dissolve and disappeared. One description is full about how it relates to me and my interpretations and the meaning it has to me. Description was just, oh, this is what's actually happening in the present moment, and this is what happens as I try to bring my attention to the present moment experience. Was I successful in indicating to you a difference between two modes of relating your experience, how to relate to your experience? And because Upandita was so strict about how we had to report the experience, I learned very quickly not only how to report, but I learned very quickly how to stay present in my moment-to-moment experience without making up some story about how I'm related to myself. Some idea of having myself, my history, my biography, and all those things. Just this in the present moment, this in the present moment, this in the present moment. It's such a relief just being with the simplicity of our experience over and over and over again. And it is a kind of undoing. And as we begin undoing more and more, the natural luminosity and clarity and freedom of our hearts and mind will have a chance to begin breaking free. It's kind of like a little baby bird inside of its egg. And has this, you know, you have this huge shell. And the practice is tapping away at the shell until it breaks, and then the bird flies free. So the practice of mindfulness, the practice of seeing very clearly what is the actual simple experience at this very moment. Our breathing, our physical experience, our feeling tone, our mental states, our thoughts. To see it, this is what's happening now. This is what's happening now. If you learn how to say it, to see things that way, really sharply, this is what's happening now, you'll find that you're not going to be burdened or tied, entangled your experience. I remember I told a story recently. I was when I did my first Vipassana retreat in Thailand. It was a long retreat, and I was doing a lot of practice. And at the end of my time there, the abbot invited me to come with him to a funeral. I never understood why he wanted me to come. It was a funeral of some high-ranking Thai general in some gaudy temple in Bangkok. And I didn't speak a word of Thai. I had no idea what was going on during the ceremony. And there was just all this chanting and talking and stuff going on. And I got more and more bored And as I got more and more bored, I got more and more depressed. Kind of, not exactly depressed, but more kind of lethargic, heavy. And I had all these ideas about, you know, why am I here? And I could be back practicing. And what's really important for me is to practice hard and get back to the monastery where I can practice. And this is really ridiculous. And it's ridiculous for me to be here. And all these thoughts and ideas, all this doing was just, you know. And then in the middle of the funeral ceremony, I said, wait a minute. I'm in 6 weeks mindfulness practice. Why don't I try continuing in the practice? So as soon as I did that, my energy kind of lifted. I became more alert and present. And I freed myself very quickly from all the judgments about what it meant to be there. And I just started doing, this is what's happening now, this is what's happening now, this is what's happening now. Sounds of foreign language I don't understand. Not foreign, I guess, in Thailand, but sound of a language I don't understand. And sounds of bells and sounds of chanting and discomfort in my butt for this hard seat I'm sitting in. And just, this is what's happening now, this is happening. And as I started doing this, very quickly, within 5 or 10 minutes, I got really light and became actually kind of joyous for me to be there. And it didn't matter where I wound up, but I happened to be there in the funeral. I just was doing my practice, and I no longer was entangled. I no longer was caught up in my interpretations. Of course, I had them periodically. But I would have this interpretation, oh, this idea, what am I doing here? Or, this is terrible. This is boring. This guy goes on and on, you know. This, you know, talking, whatever, like I'm doing now, right? Maybe some of you are having this thought yourself. And you're welcome to have it. But what you're being asked to do as a practitioner is to simply, in the raw simplicity, notice you're having whatever thought and don't entangle yourself with it. Oh, it's just a thought. As opposed to being pulled in and seduced by it and then making elaborations and letting the thought kind of get heavy and constrict the forehead or the feet or the chest or give you kind of itchy feet ready to bolt out the door. And, you know, if you feel this great urge, you know, to look at your watch, you know, is it, what time is it? Getting time to leave now? Or we get entangled and caught up. We just thought, this is what's happening now. This is what's happening now. So may all of you begin having a deep appreciation of bare attention and how bare attention will clarify so much of your life. We have 2 minutes. Would anyone like to bring up some important points? Yes, please. Well, I think bare attention is a very powerful practice in that situation and will make it much more easier for you to know how to respond. Because if you can just be with a person crying or be with a person upset and you say, oh, this person's upset. Oh, and this makes me contracted or this makes me afraid or this makes me sad. And just see it in the simplicity of it. Then you're less likely to get into all the meanings and judgment, associations and reactions that can make the whole situation more complicated. For example, it's possible to go into situations where you have the interpretation, this is too difficult for me. I don't know how to handle this. This is too much for me. And that's just an interpretation. And just see it as, I'm having this thought. It's too much for me. That's just an interpretation. Let's come back to the basic experience here. Let me just be with this person who's distressed. If you can come back and just be with the simplicity of a person who's distressed, your response won't be through the filters of all your fears and associated ideas. It'll be much more of a heartful response. And from that heartful response and from that kind of clarity, of you'll actually know much better what's needed in the situation and what kind of response you should do. Mindfulness is not to only make you a zombie. It just, you know, just sits around and just, oh, this is what's happening now, this is what's happening now, this is what's happening now, you know, and, you know, the whole world's falling apart around you. oh, the world's falling apart, the world's falling apart. You know, I don't like it. Oh, it's a thought. The practice of mindfulness is supposed to prepare you so you can actually then respond with much more skill. And so I talk to people in distress situations a lot, and I use the practice all the time, because, and if I didn't, it would be much more complicated for me. I'd have a lot less clarity about what to do.
Well, you wouldn't say that to the other person who's crying.
Oh, you're just crying. Just crying. When I had my traveler's check stolen in Calcutta, I went back to visit Manindra, who was a Vipassana teacher living in Calcutta, and I told him what happened, and he said, the practice is to be simple, but not to be a simpleton. So you have to use your best understanding, definitely use your intelligence, and try to figure out what's the best thing to do and what's the best thing to say. But if you have left your primary experience completely behind, then you might not even be talking to the person what's really going on. I mean, it happens to me. For example, sometimes I'll be talking with someone and I'll have some brilliant idea about what they need to hear and what they need to do. And so I've learned through painful experience that it's good not to rush, you know, with my advice. And so and let people finish talking at least. And it happens often enough that they continue talking and just going on. I realized that my first impulse, my first initial take of what was going on was completely off. But it's very easy to get a first take on something, a first impression. And then to build elaborations and associate thinking and be carried away by it and be entangled with it and actually lose touch with the person who's distressed. I mean, you're kind of in touch with it. You know the person's distressed, but you're not really paying attention. So, I'm somewhat apologetic for talking so much. I feel apologetic today. That's what's happening. So with that, may all of you discover bare attention. Friends, I thought of talking some more on the topic that I talked on last Monday in Palo Alto on community, on Sangha, because it's such a centrally important topic for people doing Buddhist practice. As many of you know, there's something in Buddhism called the three jewels or the three treasures. Sometimes it's called the three refuges, the three supports for practice. And in a traditional Buddhist setting, these three refuges, three treasures, provide the very important context within which the mindfulness practice is done. The context and the support for it. It's traditionally considered to be somewhat difficult to maintain a strong, steady practice of meditation and mindfulness of Buddhist practice. And so it's considered to be essential to have some kind of support for it. Just to do it on your own is considered almost impossible. And there's many kinds of support that's available to people, and each person can kind of find their own as they need. But one way of kind of traditionally summarizing the support is the three treasures are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And the Buddha is, most simplistically, is the Buddha himself. Without him having discovered what he discovered, there would be no Buddhist practice, we wouldn't be sitting here today in this room if it hadn't been for the awakening of the Buddha 2,500 years ago. So he becomes very important. But more profoundly, the Buddha is considered to be the potential for each of us to be awakened, the awakened possibility, the possibility to be free of the various forces that bind us, that keep us limited, that keep our compassion held in. The Dharma is traditionally considered to be the teaching and the practices that the Buddha taught. And we're supported by that, to have some good sense of what those practices are, good sense of what the possibilities of, are inherent in doing those practices, is a great support for people. Otherwise, you're kind of confused, and you might actually use the practice a little bit in a confused way. So it's actually possible, without a clear sense and understanding what the practice is, to spend a lot of time just kind of treading water, sometimes even having difficult experiences rising out of the practice without some sense of what the practice is. More profoundly, the Dharma is often talked about in many different ways, but the Dharma is also another word that Buddhists sometimes use for nature, the laws of nature, the patterns of nature, the interconnectedness, the laws of cause and effect within nature. And poetically, for example, in Japanese tradition, they talk about how the leaves and the trees and rustling leaves and the gurgling brooks and whatever are all preaching the Dharma. You don't have to hear the Dharma talks just from the person, but you can just hear them in nature directly. And then there's a Sangha, and the Sangha is has various definitions. One of the definitions is the narrowest and most traditional definition is that community of people who have had a taste of what awakening is, who have been a witness to the awakened state, the awakened nature. And one of the reasons to defining so narrowly is that those people are considered to be the most reliable people to put your trust in, or the most reliable people who can point you in the direction the practice is going. People who haven't tasted the awakened state, they're liable to make all kinds of mistakes. And so, since most Buddhist practitioners have a taste of awakening in its full potential, it's considered that most Buddhist communities then are made up of many various kinds of people, and in that many of them are not particularly awakened or haven't had that experience of... they're certainly liable to make a lot of mistakes in relationship to the practice. So, the reason to narrow the definition of what the Sangha is was to narrow it to those which were most reliable. But most people here in America, and I think also many times in Asia, really prefer not to keep it that narrow, because we find tremendous support in the community of people with. And so the Sangha then is often defined as simply the community of practitioners, the people who have the intention to devote themselves to truth and to mindfulness and compassion. It includes all of us. We are the Sangha. We are our Sangha for each other. And Kanando is an extended version of our Sangha, and all people who practice. Some people will extend the definition of Sangha to be beyond Buddhists. All people who are involved in some kind of spiritual practice are the Sangha. And some people like to expand it to include all beings, that all living beings are the Sangha. And some people feel a tremendous interconnectedness, and that defines the Sangha for them. And then occasionally you find people who want to expand it even larger definition of Sangha to include all insentient beings, inanimate beings, or non-beings, inanimate objects. So rocks and mountains and rivers are also the Sangha. So it's for you to kind of figure out where you want to draw the limits. It's nice to have this idea that the community has no limits. It's I like it to some degree, because to have too narrow a bounded idea of who we are, to have boundaries, this is who I am and that's who they are, kind of self and other, creates a lot of difficulties. And so if we have a sense of porous boundaries of the Sangha, we don't have some kind of narrow-minded idea of who's inside and outside. But in a sense, we include everyone in our hearts. Now the Sangha is, of the three treasures, is the one that's most often overlooked in America. People put a lot of emphasis on the Buddha and awakening. People put a lot of emphasis on the teachings and the practice here. And we have wonderful retreat centers devoted in America to intensive retreat practice. IMS in Massachusetts is really a place to do intensive meditation, to really focus on the Dharma and the possibility of awakening. But IMS doesn't really focus on the community. It's very poor on it, actually. It's been almost de-emphasized. And Spirit Rock also, to some degree, which is now the big retreat center here in California, is also a place for intensive retreats and for practice and teachings and awakening. But a community gets emphasized more at Spirit Rock than in IMS. But people who go try to enter the community of Spirit Rock as a Sangha find that it's not really, not much there. The community life is kind of difficult to kind of feel connected to a community there in a strong way. And what I feel is one of the next important developments for the American Vipassana movement is the stronger sense of emphasis on Sangha. Not so much to overemphasize it, but simply to bring it into balance so that Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha are seen as being equals. They're equal value, and that's the traditional way they're understood. They're of equal value, and they need both. All three of them need to be there as three legs to a tripod, which provides us support for the practice. So the Sangha is important, and we're exploring that. And I think what's happening for our community here in the Mid-Peninsula is that over the years we're developing a community, a Sangha of practitioners, not just simply a place where people can come as individuals to practice, but a place where people feel that their own practice, individual practice, is occurring in the context of other people who are practicing. And for no other reason, this is very important because it's, as I said earlier, it's very difficult to practice alone. And one of the reasons for that is that some of the values that get born in our hearts out of practice, when we start feeling more content and more at peace with ourselves and more sensitive to love around us, that we naturally kind of begin turning away from some of the consumeristic values of our culture. We naturally turn away from some of the values of our country, of our culture, which tend to alienate people from each other, tends to create separation, tends to numb the heart. And it's very hard to do that alone, to kind of go counter to cultural norms and standards. People don't understand. A friend of mine who was many years, but just didn't find that the particular line of work in the way she was doing it very satisfying for herself, and found herself being alienated from herself more and more, and decided to take some years off from being a doctor. She'd saved some money. And started exploring other things, artwork, for example, practice, meditation practice, and she found it very hard, not simply because her family and her friends were telling her that she was weird to do that, and when are you going to get back on the true track and, you know, get a real job and you know, keep adding money to your IRA and things like that, but she had internalized a lot of these values. And it was the internalized voices that really were troublesome for her. Because she had this idea, she wasn't married at the time that I was first talking to her, and she didn't have a marriage, she didn't have a child, she didn't have a house, she didn't have a station wagon, she didn't have children, she didn't have a dog. And there were all these things that she kind of thought you're supposed to have, you know, kind of in order to be successful. And she could kind of laugh at it in a sense and see how silly it was. But it was actually embedded much more deeper in her psyche, these cultural norms. And she struggled with it. And it took her a number of years to kind of free herself from it. And now she's come through it and found a wonderful career for herself, a new career. And she needed those years of kind of being in transition to find this new way for herself. So to be around people who understand the value of personal development, personal growth, of other values, becomes indispensable, I think, sooner or later in doing a spiritual practice. Spiritual practice will change you and change your values, and then it's helpful to be around those values so you don't feel so alone. Also, spiritual practice, also in a community, means that the community becomes a mirror for us, which sometimes is desirable and sometimes in our little mind, our little ego mind, is a very undesirable thing, of course. And my first motivation to go to a spiritual community, to live in one, around one, San Francisco Zen Center, was I wanted to be around people who were going to mirror me in the ways my normal friends, normal people in society weren't doing it, or I wasn't allowing them to do it. And I found that when I hung out with the people who did a lot of practice, that some of the normal ego trips that I acted on and lived by, and the ways I wanted to project myself so that people would see me in a certain way and get reinforced in a certain way, my normal friends were quite willing to play those games. But the people who did a lot of Buddhist practice, I noticed, didn't play those games so much. And so I would go and talk a certain way or try to get a certain response, and the response I got was a mirror. I just see myself in the response. They wouldn't respond or something. I'd be left there, you know, telling them how wonderful I was. You know, you should know how great I am and wonderful. I've done these great things. Oh, that's nice. No, you think you're kind of special. I remember once getting very excited about something and going to one of my Zen teachers, and he said, you know, this wasn't just simply being a mirror, he was actually feeding back. He said to me, you know, when I'm talking to you, sometimes I feel like I'm talking to a drug addict. That was a strong thing to say. Because I was so caught up in my ideas and my thoughts and what was important, and in making sure that everybody else understood this was important. So that got my attention. Oh, you didn't hear? I'm sorry. So when I talked to one of my Zen teachers, at some point he told me that when he talks to me, he feels like he's talking to a drug addict. And the reason being, he felt, because I was so attached and so preoccupied with my ideas and convincing everyone else of my good ideas, and you know. So got my attention, and I realized how much I was driven by my attachment to my ideas. So that was very powerful to see that. So living in, and so most of my encounters with other practitioners, wasn't as dramatic as that. So, some of them are more dramatic, but we'll leave those for now. And I saw myself in the people around me. And of course, I saw myself in people who weren't practitioners either. Also, anyone can be our mirrors. It's interesting, the word significant other, coined the word. What he had in mind was those people who signify, the signifying others. Not people who are important, the important others, but rather the people who signify us back, the people who mirror us back, the people who reflect back on us what is significant. So anyone can be in that role. I had a conversation with the cashier at Whole Foods earlier this week that was very impactful for me. You know, you can have very impactful conversations in a very short time, just, you know, in the checkout counter. What impact for me with her? She's African American, and in the course of this short conversation, the way the conversation went, she told me that she felt that this community that she's part of now, I don't know exactly what she meant, but she was certainly working in Palo Alto, was the most racist community she'd ever been in. And I was a little bit taken back by that, and then she listed some of the different communities she lived in, and she lived for 7 years in Guam, maybe as part of the military there, I don't know. And she felt there, everybody lived together very equally. Then she lived in Massachusetts, I'm not sure where, She felt much more equality there than she did in this community here, where she felt was much more racist. And that was impactful to hear that. I thought. And I don't know exactly her experiences, but I left and I reflected and thought, well, some of the things she described about the racism, I thought were probably entangled with classism. And sometimes I think racism is invisible in the classism that exists in this community here. So I thought that was very interesting. And to have that, you know, that really kind of set me thinking for a number of days. It's a very short little encounter of some kind of mirroring that I got from one woman. It doesn't have to be the Buddhist community that you're in. But the Buddhist community, the Sangha, I think often offers a different kind of mirroring than many people outside of a Sangha. Because the one of the things that I think for me, and again, it's the ideal, one of the things that a Sangha offers that hopefully all communities offer this, but hopefully one of the things that a Sangha offers that I think perhaps is different than a lot of other communities that you might be involved in, is that a Sangha is dedicated to never back to anyone. That the Sangha is offering a place where anybody can come and practice. And practice means to work, where everybody works to clarify their attachments, their projections, their confusions. And that to some degree or other, and it's a little bit awkward, you know, all the degrees, and we don't have all the forum and all the possibilities here as we could, as we become more developed and grow. But we don't turn away from anyone. Anybody can come through the door. And if we end up in conflict with someone, if we don't like someone because of what they said to us or get upset by someone, we don't shun that person from the community, or we don't avoid that person and give them a cold shoulder. But we say, we include you, and even we might not always like you, but we're willing to work with you and find some way that we can be together. And I found in the communities I was involved in, there were a lot of people whom I normally wouldn't have had anything to do with in normal society. Thank you. But here we were together in the same community, practicing together, and we had this common practice that we shared. And I developed friendships with people I normally wouldn't develop friendships with. Or there were people who I never really became friends with exactly, but I felt that we were kind of like in the village together. We were kind of like in it together, and I felt a certain kind of camaraderie-ness with them. And even though maybe some of them I never really liked occasionally, I never really liked them, I still very much included them as part of my heart, part of my community, my family, while I was practicing with them. And I've been lots of situations of conflict in my years of being in Buddhist communities. I remember one person telling me, pulling me aside and telling me, maybe I should say this was many, many years ago. So I hope they have changed a little bit since then. But he said to me, "If you weren't so sincere, I would punch you out." So we had a few things to talk about. So to hang in there, you know, so this is one of the things I feel. Since I feel this is so important, it's one of the things that I offer. I think anyone, ideally, anybody who's going to be a Buddhist teacher, a spiritual teacher, has at least this commitment. And the commitment is not that they're wise necessarily, or that their commitment is not necessarily that they understand everything or perfect. The commitment rather is that if they make a mistake, that they're willing to hang in there and work it out. And that to me is, that's one of the commitments. The other commitment is, as a Buddhist teacher, is never to turn away from suffering. If someone comes to you with their suffering, no matter how horrible and difficult it is for you to be there for it, you're committed not to turn away, to stay there for it. Those two things I think are really important. And so Buddhist teachers offer commitment more than they offer wisdom, luckily. So, and this is important for our community because, at least it's important for me because I make mistakes in our community. I say things which maybe sometimes are, I think it's rare that I say things in a mean-spirited intention, but somehow even with good intention, sometimes I say things casually or with insensitivity. And or sometimes I don't even know what effect I have on people, and the intention, the way my intonation, my voice, or something is such that people take it very personally. Or and I'm surprised sometimes to hear stories. It's happened a few times in our history here, where someone will wait 2 years, maybe not even come for a couple of years. And they come back and say, the tone of your voice when you said a certain thing to me, really hurt me. And I shouldn't give examples, but and it can be very, maybe I'll give one example. It can be very mild. I asked someone to help with the chairs, putting away the chairs after Monday night once, and somehow the way that the tone of my voice and the way I said it, it felt in some way, and they felt very hurt. And the person didn't come back for 2 years. And then they said, I need to talk to you about something. And so then we talked about it. And what's hard after 2 years is that I don't remember what I said. I don't remember. It's very hard for me to kind of apologize or understand the context of it after that long. So this is one thing that as a teacher I offer, is I offer to meet anyone who I feel that I've offended. I don't promise not to offend anyone. That's impossible, but I offer to at least meet and work it out, and as a community, there's support in the community for that's needed. So a community, a sangha, I feel, is a place where people can. We don't turn our back to anyone. We're there to hang out, to work things out, and be open to each other. It also offers a very wonderful opportunity for a place where people can experiment a little bit. It's maybe a safe place to experiment, where you don't necessarily know how. Like when I was an early practitioner, living in the San Francisco Zen Center, a safe community, people weren't going to throw me out, unless I did something really terrible, they weren't going to throw me out. So I thought, I can start experimenting with being in different ways than the way I usually am. So I would try on different ways of being together in social circumstances with people and see what it was like. And for a while, I tried out not talking much. And just being silent a lot more. Just waiting until people talk to me. And in normal society, that was a very frightening thing for me to do because I felt like I had to rush in and fill the conversation and make sure people knew where I was. But I experimented with being silent for a lot and not talking. Then there was a period of time where I experimented with being an open book, with just letting people know whatever was going on for me. Whoever would listen, I would tell them, just whatever I was thinking, And so that was my experiment for a while and see what that was like. And then I experimented with all kinds of things, ways, because my old way of being, I didn't feel served me anymore, didn't feel right. And I didn't have any new way, I didn't have some handy way of being otherwise, and it felt kind of awkward. So I felt very lucky to be in a community where I could be awkward for a while until I found what felt natural for me or what felt natural coming out of my place of practice. So sangha is also a place to experiment perhaps a little bit, of being a little bit differently. And some of you might want to be in this community and never talk to anyone for a few years. And it's really nice to be here in that way. And all you do is ever talk everywhere else. And some of you are really afraid to talk to other people. And so, well, this is a place, well, I'll try it here. Try it out. Now, in our... I think one of the great sufferings in America is the American philosophy of individualism. Most of us, consciously or unconsciously, have bought into it. And it means that we put tremendous emphasis on our individuality, on our individual freedom from inhibition of all kinds, individual accomplishments and needs. And in an extreme form, individualism is an impossibility. Because no, what's the expression? No man is an island. No woman is an island. No one is an island. No one is an individual. And we have this common saying in America, to be yourself. Has anyone ever advised you to just be yourself in that situation? Just be yourself. You know, everything will be okay. Well, it's a nice, you know, in a kind of loose, kind of light way. It's kind of, but it's an impossibility to be yourself. It's as impossible to be yourself as it is to speak your own private language. You know, what good does it do to speak your own language and no one else speaks? We have to speak a language we share with other people. In the same way, we can't be ourselves. Who we are, we discover who we are in the relationship to other people to a great degree. And it becomes a real tension, I think. If we're trying to find ourselves as an individual, unique and separate from everyone else, we set up a tremendous tension with not only our need to be involved and connected to other people, but, I mean, the kind of emotional need or whatever, but it's in the very structure of being a human being, that social human being. And so we set up a tension with, you know, between our ideal of being unique and individual with the kind of inherent in our structure to be social beings. Some scientists have, or some psychologists or anthropologists have argued that that there's a kind of a blind spot. There's a kind of this sense of self which human beings develop was born so that we can be better social beings. But it's kind of created, but it makes us kind of myopic about what's really going on. So there are advantages to being in a sangha, and certainly there can be disadvantages to being involved in a sangha. Certainly one of them can be if we think we're right and they're wrong. I've been in enough Buddhist communities where there was maybe either strong or small or a light sense that this is the right place to be to practice, and to be, not be in this place in practice somewhere else, they're doing the wrong practice. Oh, it's too bad, you know. People who left one of the Buddhist communities I was involved in, they kind of sense what the true Dharma. You know, they've gone to those other Buddhists. They don't really understand it completely well. And I think that's, you know, a real, real big problem to have any kind of notion like that. And as soon as you have a sangha community, you have a culture, and cultures always have blind spots; they have their shadows. But if you're going to avoid being involved in any community, any group, because it has a shadow, you're never going to be involved with anyone. You're going to go live in a hermit someplace. So, you know, if you only relate to the shadow of a community, then you're doing yourself a disservice. If you only relate to the light of a community, you're also doing yourself a disservice. And part of the function of Buddhist practice is to clarify and criticize or clarify or draw out, to highlight the shadow. And you need to have both. If you only have the culture, then the shadow tends to be invisible. But you need the practice to draw it out so the community becomes safe. And in Buddhist communities where there isn't much practice, it tends to be a big shadow. One of the shadows in Buddhist communities is anger. Because Buddhists are supposed to be kind, right? That's kind of like, you know, it's kind people are kind, you know, and loving kindness and all that, you know. And so if you're a culture where you're supposed to be kind, kindness has a high value and compassion has a high value, that means that anger and hostility, you know, are kind of no-nos. And if it's a no-no, then you push it into the shadow. You don't, you know, you put on a nice face and everything's fine. So it's probably a good shadow to have in the sense that being kind is a nice thing. I think it's good. But it's very important then to go to that and to see, oh, maybe I'm not really acknowledging my anger, or maybe I'm not speaking it, or maybe I'm not recognizing it. But this idea, this emphasis on individuality and individualism in America also lends itself sometimes to a resistance and a hesitation, a fear of being involved in community life. So for all kinds of reasons. For one reason, oh, I'm going to be obligated. There's going to be all kinds of obligations. They're going to want something from me. I'm going to have to extend myself in ways that I don't want to. I think there's many kind of fears that people have involved in a community. And, you know, I think to some degree it's good to face our fears. And some of our fears are good fears. And some of our fears are maybe more have to do with self-protection than they have to do with kind of neurotic self-protection that have to do with something real. And so if we only listen to our fears, we shortchange ourselves really dramatically. And there is a value to extending yourself into a community and getting to know people, letting people get to know you. Life is made up of a lot of encounters. And the question is, what do we bring to the encounter? How do we allow other people to encounter us? And how do we encounter other people? Occasionally we meet someone who seems very trustworthy and kind of inspiring. And we encounter them and we begin talking with them. We find we trust them. And in trusting them, we begin talking about ourselves or talking about them. And we find sometimes that we learn about ourselves in that encounter. Have you ever had that? But it takes a certain kind of trust and openness in encountering another person to discover a little bit about ourselves. There's a lot we won't learn about ourselves unless we put ourselves in relationship to other people to learn about ourselves. And it's very common for some people to set up a kind of worldview or idea or philosophy or religious idealism that they understand. Because it's very, very easy to have understanding. It's all too easy. And it's very easy to have a little bit of a kind of emotional sense to go with that understanding that makes it feel, oh, it's really personal and deep. You know, it's more than just understanding, it's in my body. And for that understanding to be self-sufficient, self-contained, and to be very myopic and very narrow. And huge areas of who we are left out of bounds because we're kind of in this understanding. And it's the encounter with other people and sharing understanding with other people that allows us to kind of break the shell of that and see deeper and deeper. In the Zen tradition, of course, they have this done almost in a formal way, in a ritualistic way, where one of the things you're expected to do in a Zen community is to bring your best understanding of your spiritual life to the teacher and see what the teacher does. And sometimes the teacher, you know, says, "Great, that sounds good to me." Or sometimes the teacher will kind of poke. Well, maybe you haven't looked at everything. Maybe this. Oh, you haven't really looked at this part. Or maybe, you know, that's quite good what you say, but you know, you're completely ignoring your anger. You know, how does that fit into all this equation? And part of the value of being with a community over time, or being with a teacher over time, is that they get to know you really well, so they can call you on things that you don't see for yourself. In the Zen tradition, they do it very dramatically. They have this what's called Dharma combat. Can you believe it? We're so kind here, you know. Can you imagine being in combat with me over the Dharma? And what it would be is we'd form an aisle right down the middle here, and you'd all sit to the side, and you'd all take turns standing in the back of the room, and you'd present me with a question that really encapsulated your deepest understanding of the truth or life, and just present this question or present this understanding, and I would just let you have it, you know, let you know. You know, and dueling dharmas. And so it's a little odd thing to do. In the San Francisco Zen Center, they dropped the Japanese name Dharma Combat, and now they call it Dharma Inquiry.
We have
Oh, anyway, so it's I love doing it because it puts you on your toes a little bit in a way that it's kind of nice sometimes. Now, some people shouldn't be put on their toes because they're on their toes all the time, and it just pushes them over the edge. But some people, you know, are so confident and so firmly established in their way that they need something dramatic to get their attention, and this gets their attention. So maybe one day we should do that here, huh? Maybe we'll do it optional. Maybe we'll set it up as time, and we'll see who comes to have Dharma come back. So, you know, most of you don't know that my Japanese Buddhist name is two parts. And one part is Dragon Tusk. That's a strong name, huh? Come and face the dragon's tusk. And the other half of the name has something to do with sunlight. So you can choose which side you want. It's two sides. So community, I'm trying to emphasize here the problems of community and also the fears that people have, and to really understand your fears around community. On Monday, when I talked about this topic on Monday night, I wasn't so long-winded, so we actually took time and we broke into groups and small groups, and we talked about, I asked people in the groups to talk about two things. Something like the advantages or benefits they each saw in being involved in a sangha, in a spiritual community. And the second topic was, what are the fears you have about being involved in a spiritual community? Those two things. The advantages and the fears of you individually. And I apologize, you know, we're basically out of time now. So maybe it's something you want to discuss as we break up now, if you stay behind. Or maybe we can pick up this topic in some weeks or some point and have more time to break up into groups to discuss it. But it's a wonderful thing to have a place where... It's a wonderful thing to meditate and to settle on oneself. And then from that settledness, to begin encountering the world and finding out how to be in the world from this. That's a really wonderful thing. And hopefully a Sangha community is a wonderful bridge that helps us to get... It's kind of like a place for training wheels to learn how to begin bringing that settled place into the rest of our life. I'd like to end by reading a story, if you allow me to, and about how you might encounter other people, relate to other people. Part of the function of the story, in reading it to you, is hopefully to help let the story be a mirror to encourage you to reflect on how is it you encounter other people. What do you bring? What are the attitudes, the values, the projections, the judgments and stuff that you bring when you encounter another person, when you allow another person to encounter you? Because this offers a different, probably a little bit different than the way you usually are with people. This story concerns a monastery that had fallen upon hard times. Once a great order, as a result of waves of anti-monastic persecution in the 17th and 18th centuries, and the rise of secularism in the 19th, and wars and technological development in the 20th century, and internet speed in the 1990s, branch houses were lost, and it had become decimated to the extent that there were only 5 monks left in the decaying mother house. The abbot and 4 others, all over 70 in age. Clearly, it was a dying order. In the deep woods surrounding the monastery, there was a little hut that a rabbi from a nearby town occasionally used for hermitage. Through their many years of prayer and contemplation, the old monks had become a bit psychic, so they could always sense when the rabbi was in his hermitage. Quote, "The rabbi is in the woods," again, they would whisper to each other. As he agonized over the imminent death of his order, it occurred to the abbot, at one such time, to visit the hermitage and ask the rabbi if by some possible chance he could offer any advice that might save the monastery. The rabbi welcomed the abbot at his hut. But when the abbot explained the purpose of his visit, the rabbi could only commiserate with him. "I know how it is," he exclaimed. "The spirit has gone out of the people. It is the same in my town. Almost no one comes to the synagogue anymore." So the old abbot and the old rabbi wept together. Then they read parts of the Torah and quite things. The time came when the abbot had to leave. They embraced each other. "It has been a wonderful thing that we should meet after all these years," the abbot said. "But I have still failed in my purpose for coming here. Is there nothing you can tell me, no piece of advice you can give me, that would help me save my dying order?" "No, I'm sorry," the rabbi responded. "I have no advice to give. The only thing I can tell you is that the Messiah is one of you." When the abbot returned to the monastery, his fellow monk asked, "Well, what did the rabbi say?" "He couldn't help," the abbot answered. "We just wept and read the Torah together. The only thing he did say, just as I was leaving, it was something cryptic, was that the Messiah is one of us. I don't know what he meant." In the days and weeks and months that followed, the old monks pondered this and wondered whether there was any possible significance in the rabbi's words. The Messiah is one of us? Could he possibly have meant one of us monks here at the monastery? If that's the case, which one? Do you suppose he meant the abbot? Yes, he meant Father Abbot. He's been our leader for more than a generation. On the other hand, he might have meant Brother Thomas. Certainly Brother Thomas is a holy man. Everyone knows that Thomas is a man of light. Certainly he could not have meant Brother Elred. Elred gets crotchety at times. But come to think of it, even though he is a thorn in people's sides, when you look back on it, Elred is virtually always right, often very right. Maybe the rabbi did mean Brother Elred, but perhaps not surely not Brother Philip. Philip is so passive, a real nobody. Almost mysteriously, he has a gift for somehow always being there when you need him. He just magically appears by your side. Maybe Philip is the Messiah. Of course, the rabbi didn't mean me. He couldn't possibly have meant me. I'm just an ordinary person. Yet suppose he did. Suppose I am the Messiah. Oh God, not me. I couldn't be that much of you, could I? As they contemplated in this manner, the old monks began to treat each other with extraordinary respect on the off chance that one among them might be the Messiah. And on the off chance that each monk himself, they began to treat themselves with extraordinary respect. Because the forest in which it was situated was beautiful, it so happened that people still occasionally came to visit the monastery, even now and then to go into the dilapidated chapel to meditate. As they did so, without even being conscious of it, they sensed this aura of extraordinary respect that now began to surround the five old monks that seemed to radiate out from them and permeate the atmosphere of the place. There was something strangely attractive, even compelling about it. Hardly knowing why, they began to come back to the monastery to picnic, to play, to pray. They began to bring friends to show them this special place, and their friends brought their friends. Then it happened that some of the younger men who came to visit the monastery started to talk more and more with the old monks. After a while, one asked if he could join them, then another and another. So within a few years, the monastery had once again become a thriving order, and thanks to the rabbi's gift, a vibrant center of light and spirituality in the realm. Is the Buddha to be? Could it be? It could be.